This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello and welcome to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Australians have long been told to cut back on saturated fats to reduce our risk of heart disease. But this week, new evidence emerged questioning the link between saturated fats and heart disease. We'll hear from leading Sydney cardiologist Dr. Ross Walker about what we should and shouldn't be eating. There's currently a push to introduce more tourism and development to national parks. So are national parks underutilised? Matt McClelland from Wild Walks and from the National Parks Association of New South Wales gives us the facts about visitor numbers and also the purpose of national parks. Do boring men make the best husbands? That's the claim from single girl and celibate in the city blogger Joanna Hayes. Find out exactly what she means by that. The Monuments Men is a war movie starring George Clooney, Matt Damon, Bill Murray and Cate Blanchett. But does it live up to expectations created by the all-star cast? Ben McKechnie gives his verdict. And we talk to the CEO of City to City Australia about why they're bringing New York pastor and New York Times best-selling author Tim Keller to Australia. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. Many Australians have been led to believe that saturated fats found in meat, butter and cheese are a cause of heart disease. But new research published this week found that those who ate higher levels of saturated fats didn't actually have higher levels of heart disease than those who ate less saturated fat. So what's this all about? Dr. Ross Walker is a Sydney-based cardiologist who speaks and writes about health. Hi, Dr. Walker.
Hello, Katrina.
Are these findings significant in your view?
Look, they're significant, but I've been saying this for years. I wrote a book in 2002 called The Cell Factor, where I said there is no relationship between saturated fat intake and heart disease. But unfortunately, many conservative thinkers in this area have just kept this nonsense going. And this is just yet another piece of evidence that confirms what I've been saying. Last year, for example, there's a study out looking at the intake of meat versus the intake of delicatessen meats and bacon and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it showed that if you had natural meats as part of your diet, and it should never be the central focus of anyone's diet, but if you have natural meats as part of your diet, you had no increased risk for heart disease. But if you regularly consume delicatessen meats and bacon, 40% increased risk for heart disease. So we've got to look at the sort of meat we're talking about, and we're not suggesting people can go crazy with the bacon or the cakes or anything like that, because the other problem is also we haven't mentioned trans fatty acids.
Well, that's what I was just about to ask about, because we're always hearing that that trans fats are the real no-nos. And I'm wondering, do these actually occur naturally in whole foods, or do they only pop up in processed foods?
No, you can get natural trans fatty acids. But it's interesting here, and this gets back to even another analogy, is the fructose debate. There is natural fructose that you get in fruit, but there's synthetic fructose that's in a lot of these altered sweeteners. So, for example, in America, if you have a can of Coke, you have this high fructose corn syrup, which is synthetic fructose, and it's totally different in the same way that the natural trans fats that you get in meat, eggs and dairy to a lesser extent are in very small amounts and completely harmless, like saturated fat. But it's the synthetic trans fats that don't occur naturally, that actually are produced by a process called hydrogenation, which is the chemical process you use to thicken and harden food with altered vegetable oil. So when you see a box or a container that has on the side of it vegetable oil, they're missing out a very important word, which is hydrogenated vegetable oil, which is therefore a trans fat. So for example, if you have a piece of steak every day of your life, that's a 5% increase in saturated fat. And there's, from these studies, there's no increased risk for heart disease. But if you have a croissant or a donut, or one of the greatest oxymorons on the planet, a low-fat muffin every day, that's a 2% increase in trans fatty acids. That translates to a 93% increase for cardiovascular risk.
Wow. So what's the thing on the packet that we really got to look out for? Is it vegetable oil or is it hydrogenated vegetable oil?
They won't put hydrogenated. They'll just put vegetable oil. So if it says vegetable oil on the packet, you know they're using hydrogenated fats. And let me tell you another wonderful con job here. In New York a few years back, they came out and said, our restaurants are not allowed anymore to cook in trans fatty acids. So they thought, oh, isn't this wonderful, wonderful health innovation by the people of New York? But what they do is they use a different process called interesterification, which still creates a synthetic fat. It's just not a trans fat, and it's just as bad for your body. Because here's the essence of it. And I say to people all the time, who are the sickest people on the planet? And my patients or anyone listening to me will say, oh, fat Americans. And that's not true. The sickest people on the planet live in Africa. Why? Because they're malnourished. The worst thing for your body, apart from, of course, morbid obesity, which is a BMI greater than 40, is to be malnourished. Now, why? Because the covering of every cell in a healthy person is 75% fat. We need fat as an insulating covering to protect us against outside toxins. So you go to Africa, they're dropping like flies from HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, because they don't have enough fat in their system to be that protective coating. But here's the problem, that if you take in a trans fat, it goes straight into the membrane and makes the membranes of your cells hard and thick and very much prone to breaking down. And so this is why we get so much heart disease in people who have a lot of trans fats.
Okay, so what do you advise your patients when they ask you what they should be eating?
Oh, it's simple. I mean, I think nutrition is so simple. I can summarise it in two phrases, but then I'll go into it a bit deeper. Eat less and eat more naturally. The big problem in our society is our caloric intake. We're eating too much food, and that's number one. So I say to people, cut down on the size of your helpings, eat off smaller plates, don't have second helpings, don't have desserts most of the time, and don't graze between meals. We're not cows, for God's sake. So that's number one. Number two, if it's in a box or a container, especially if it's got a use-by date, and I don't care what graffiti is written on the box, like low fat or no cholesterol, it is graffiti. So what I say to people is try to avoid processed, packaged muck masquerading as food. And then number three is what I call white death. White death is sugar. It is white rice. It is white bread. It's pasta. It's potatoes. Try to minimize your intake of that stuff. So what should you be eating? Firstly, and most importantly, and I know this is all about saturated fat, but what I'm saying is we should really be focusing on and getting in two or three pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day. Now, a serving's about a half a carrot. Now, you say, well, that sounds easy. Well, only 10% of the modern world take in that amount of fruits and vegetables every day, and the people who do have the lowest rates of heart disease and cancer. Mm. And so the rest of your diet should be little bits, small bits of meat, eggs, dairy, chicken, fish, nuts, olive oil. It's called a Mediterranean diet. It's a very healthy diet. And in fact, the interesting thing when I mentioned the Mediterranean diet, it's more the Mediterranean lifestyle, which we don't have here in the Western world. Mm. What the Mediterraneans do, they have a good, healthy breakfast full of fresh fruits and grains and nuts. Then they have their biggest meal at lunchtime after they've been working in the fields all morning. And they have a glass of wine with the meal. They get a bit sleepy. They have a lovely afternoon sleep, which is very, very healthy for you. And then they go back into the fields and burn off all the carbs in the afternoon, and they have a small evening meal. We have a tiny breakfast, tiny lunch, huge evening meal, sit in front of the TV, and the fat doesn't get broken down. You see, the body's not like a car. If you put the fuel in the car and don't burn it straight away, it gets laid down as fat. Mm. And that's the problem. We've got our life all screwed around the wrong way.
Well, sounds easy to fix then.
Well, it's not thanks. Easy to fix because we're in ingrained habits. That's
yes,
the problem.
It's true. Well, thank you so much, though, for some words of advice this morning, Dr. Ross Walker.
Great to talk to you.
Lots
Karina.
To think about there. That is cardiologist, author and speaker Dr. Ross Walker. You can find out more about him at drrosswalker.com. An Upper House inquiry is calling for more tourism opportunities to be created in national parks, suggesting that they're currently being underutilised. The report says national parks should host more tourism ventures such as hotels and accommodation, mountain bike trails and better camping facilities. As the owner of wildwalks.com, Matt McClellan knows this country's national parks better than most people. He also works with the National Parks Association and was very involved in the campaign against introducing recreational hunting to national parks. Hi, Matt.
G'day, Katrina. How are you?
Are national parks underutilised in your view?
Look, we get 35 million visitors a year to our national parks. There's certainly scope for even more. But to understand whether they're underutilised, we need to think about the purpose of the national park. And the purpose is really around the protection of nature. Currently, we've got about 800 parks. International bodies say we need probably 1,300 parks. So I would actually say we're overutilising national parks for their actual purpose. And if I can give a quick example of that, it's like thinking Warragamba Dam is underutilised, because you're looking around and it's this beautiful waterfront property, there's no five-star hotels, there's no golf courses, but that's not the purpose of the dam, it's about water security.
Okay, so what's behind the drive to open up national parks for more tourism and development opportunities?
Yeah, there's many drivers. So, you know, last year we saw the recreational hunters wanting to open them up. In this report, we're seeing it's the alpine environment, the skiing, the downhill skiing group, and we're also seeing fossickers, people who go out doing gold panning and gold mining. So it's some recreational bodies who are really pushing for it, and I think that they haven't really understood the purpose of the national park.
So, Matt, what is the actual purpose of national parks then?
Great. So you need to go back to the National Park Act of 1974, and it's quite clear there's three purposes. It's the conservation of nature, in particular the habitat, ecosystems and biodiversity. Secondly, it's the conservation of objects. So this is places of Aboriginal significance, it's your historical artefacts and that sort of stuff. And thirdly, this is where the confusion comes in, and I'll read it out for you. It's fostering public appreciation, the understanding and enjoyment of nature and cultural heritage and their conservation. It's those last three words that are key, and their conservation. So if we're going to be fostering people, encouraging people to come to a national park, the purpose for that is for actually the conservation of nature. Whereas in this review, they said that the purpose of national parks is actually for public enjoyment, and that's not. The purpose of national parks is about the preservation of nature. So there's a real confusion from the Senate committee as to why national parks exist. And with that confusion, I can understand why they're saying there should be all these things. But if the purpose is actually what the legislation says, then there is no actual room for these things. But what there is room for our government to do is to have these facilities adjacent to national parks, so we can still get more people visiting national parks, and then using B&Bs on the outskirts of the park. So if we want to make something like the Great North Walk really popular, then we need to promote all the B&Bs along the way, so people can do these great walks and then each night have a comfortable bed and a nice warm meal and use the cafes and that sort of thing along the way.
Given that, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, kids not getting outside enough and, you know, there has been, for example, an argument that national parks aren't accessible enough, you know, do we need to make some changes so more people can actually enjoy what national parks have to offer?
Look, I think the changes don't necessarily even need to be on the ground. I think the changes need to be in how we promote national parks, how we encourage people to visit national parks. Obviously, kids aren't spending enough time in nature. Obviously, kids aren't getting that time that they need in playing in nature. But that's not because of a lack of facilities. That's because of a lack of desire within our community. And we need to be able to encourage people to get out there and enjoy these way more, all these facilities that already exist much more before we even consider building more.
Okay. And if we did need hotels and accommodation, you would argue that they should be outside the national park or alongside it?
Yeah, alongside the national park. And we've seen this in Tasmania. You've got the Overland Track, which is their iconic walk, but it's limited to only 9,000 people a year because all their infrastructure is on park and they can't grow it any bigger. And so we're much better off building this infrastructure off park where we can build these more and more facilities and we can keep people just going into the park for the day, coming out and enjoying the facilities on the edge of the park. Much more sustainable, much cheaper, much more economic benefit for the communities as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Matt, for sharing your point of view.
Thanks, Katrina.
That's Matt McClelland from the bushwalking website and app Wild Walks. He's also from the National Parks Association. Could it be true that boring men, in fact, make the best husbands? Well, that depends on your point of view. Joanna Hayes from the blog Celibate in the City says that what she looks for in a man today would be vastly different from what she would have looked for even 10 years ago. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Katrina.
Now, let's just go back in time first, yes, to Joanna Hayes, age 10. What would your ideal husband have looked like at that age?
One that I would basically never have to actually speak to or spend any time with. Age 10, still completely grossed out by the idea of boys. Mm. Found it quite weird that anyone would choose to live with one forever. And like grossed out / just confused by them. So I think particularly at age 10, if I had known about the Charlotte Lucas version of marriage, Charlotte of fame in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, marrying Mr. Collins, the most boring man in the history of the world, so so that she would basically not have to spend any time with him. I would have thought that's a pretty good idea. That's a good plan.
Oh, that's pretty tragic. Then in our late teens, kind of early 20s, when most of us sort of start, you know, getting interested in the whole concept, usually we are drawn to the exciting, cool-looking bad boy, you know, the one that we know in our heart is completely unsuitable but who has so much potential. Did you go through that phase as well?
Well, yes. And it's funny, I think the Austin metaphor continues because obviously the Mr. Wickham suddenly becomes really attractive.
Oh, yes, Mr. Wickham.
Yeah. You just are attracted to really unsuitable people who don't actually match with your personality or objectives or anything. And
I mean, I definitely did that in my late teens. Definitely.
Yeah, and it's even just embarrassing remembering some of the people I had crushes on. You're like, what was I thinking? Mm. Well, you weren't. I wasn't thinking. It was all hormones, no brain, and, you know, you're just seeking validation, I guess, through the idea of dating the hottest possible person or, you know, the most intriguing.
Intriguing was the one I would go for, yes.
He's so mysterious.
That's right. Oh. The mysterious, unpredictable, you know, never know what they're thinking.
Right,
but they're a brilliant guitarist. So, you know, that's all you really need in life, right?
That's, I'll just sit and listen to him play guitar until we're 85. That'll be... That's the plan.
Anyways, now that you're into your late 20s, I hear that you're looking for a boring man, Joanna. What do you mean by that?
Look, boring in slight quotation marks. I say boring in the sense of what I would have considered in that adolescent phase to be boring. Mm-hmm. You know, someone with, like, a job, or at least a desire to get one. Someone who is reliable, who loves his family and hangs out with his parents and helps them move house. Someone who turns up to church every week, even when he's got, you know, many things on because he wants to prioritize God and love his church family. All of those things that weren't that hot when I was 15 are becoming very attractive now.
So why are you convinced that boring men actually make the best husbands, Joanna?
Well, I think it is because they are trustworthy, which obviously is something that is vital in marriage. And I think, unfortunately, because I've seen a bit of the wreckage of friends or acquaintances marrying the person that, to a 16-year-old, is the perfect guy.
Mm.
And in the actual challenges of life, of parenthood, of going to funerals together and having to get up every day and go to work and all of the actual stuff that's actually going to occur for the next few decades of life, trustworthy and reliable are much more attractive characteristics than mysterious, moody and unstable.
Why didn't someone tell me that when I was 18?
I know.
But look, just finally, before I let you go, is there not a danger that a good, reliable, slightly boring man might actually get really boring after 20 years of marriage?
Possibly. So I think that's why I don't want to go the full Charlotte Lucas.
That's right.
I'd still like to marry someone that I'd like to spend time with, not someone who is so boring that I would fall asleep whilst speaking to them. There's got to be some interest there. But I guess I'm more open to considering things that at 16 I would have been so over.
Okay, so if you're an accountant, ring Joanna now.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Talking to Joanna Hayes from the blog celibateinthecity.net on why boring men make the best hubbies. The Monuments Men is not your average World War II film. It's about a team of soldiers whose job is to preserve the best of Western art, architecture and culture. With stars like George Clooney, Matt Damon, Bill Murray and Kate Blanchett, expectations will be high. But does it live up to those expectations? Film reviewer Ben McKechnie is the man to answer that question. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Katrina. How are you?
Not too bad. Now, what's this movie really about to start off with, Ben?
Well, actually, your introduction was excellent. You pretty much covered everything. The only thing I would add is that it's actually based on a true story. The movie embellishes on some of this, but by and large, this is fairly accurate about these soldiers running around in World War II trying to preserve art, trying to preserve monuments, trying to preserve culture. So everything from the Mona Lisa through to famous statues of Madonna and Child. They're the kind of things that the Monuments Men are trying to protect.
Okay, and does this film sort of live up to the expectations you would have of it with all those big stars?
No, I don't think it does. No. Okay. And I should also point out, George Clooney directs this. And George Clooney's directed a bunch of movies, including Syriana and The Men Who Stare at Goats. And he's a really quite a good director. But on this occasion, I reckon the main issue with the movie is that it's a war movie that often feels like there's no war in it. The nature of what these soldiers are doing, it's amazing that there was a group of people running around doing this, trying to preserve art and culture. But at the same time, when you watch it on screen, it can feel a bit, well, it's almost like it's trivializing war. It's almost putting up art on the same level as a human life. If that makes sense.
So, like, the idea that saving art is just as important as saving a
real
person.
Yeah, that's a really good encapsulation of what the Monuments Men. It doesn't go that far. Like, it pulls back from that. But, however, it does constantly justify its position as it goes along about, you know, is it worth it what we're doing? If you did risk a soldier's life, is it worth it preserving the Mona Lisa or whatever it might be?
Oh, so if a man dies, is that sacrifice worthy?
Yeah, and actually you can walk out of the Monuments Men saying that that movie is suggesting, yes, it is worth it. It is worth it. And the main way that they present that is to suggest that if you destroy culture, if you destroy artifacts, art forms, monuments, that kind of thing, then how do you know what people were like in the past? So effectively it's almost like they never existed. If you wipe out what represents those people, it may seem like they never existed. And this group of art historians turned soldiers who were battling the Nazis, who were attempting to destroy this culture, they say we need to preserve it. Otherwise, effectively, you're like wiping out a history of people, and then therefore you're wiping out people and the memory of them as well.
Well, when you consider that in the context of the fact that the Nazis were actually trying to exterminate a whole people group, maybe it becomes a little bit more justifiable to have that fear.
Yeah, look, that's right. But I think that point you just raised then is one of those points that you keep batting up against the Monuments Men, which is the Nazis were looking to destroy a race of people. That is a lot more serious than saving art, if you get my meaning. So
yeah.
when you put these two things up on the screen and start talking about rescuing art or rescuing people, and you really start making a case for rescuing culture, it just seems a bit like, really? Like you honestly think that saving paintings is as important as saving people?
And maybe it's with that context, like you said, of the fact that a war is raging and people are dying, that makes this seem a little trivial.
Yes, that's right. Now I think this whole story of the Monuments Men actually seems a bit better if you just talk about it in general. If you just talk about there were these guys going around trying to save art, you know, that's pretty interesting. And like, you can understand people might want to preserve art.
Mm.
But I think the Monuments Men goes that one step further and puts it into this, on this playing field with human life, suggesting that, yeah, if we don't preserve what people have created, then therefore they haven't existed. And, yeah, there's something about that rubs me off the wrong way. And look, I should say something quickly about the film too. Look, it's got an all-star cast, as you mentioned. Sadly, they just don't seem to bond and have a substantial banter and rapport that you would think on screen. And so mixed in with these other elements of, the tension between saving art and saving people, overall, it's just a war movie that seems quite weak, even though they're trying to do something that's actually quite culturally elite. If you're a George Clooney fan who enjoys Ocean's 11, no, you won't, apart from some of the adventure stuff that happens in this movie. If you like George Clooney's more serious films, like Syriana, I also don't think you're going to like this one as much as the others. So, like, it's got an entertaining enough, but there are plenty of other war movies out there that do much more justice to the issue of preserving a society and saving lives and saving the past. Way better war movies than your Monuments Men.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that review, Ben. Good to hear from you.
It's all right. My pleasure.
That's film reviewer Ben McKechnie giving a rather lukewarm review to The Monuments Men. It stars George Clooney, Matt Damon, Bill Murray and Cate Blanchett. Have you ever felt a desire to build deeper Christian communities that make a real impact on your city? At the end of March, there's an exciting number of events happening in Sydney that have that goal in mind. City to City Australia is bringing out renowned New York pastor Tim Keller. Best known for the New York Times bestseller, The Reason for God, Tim Keller has been described as a modern-day C.S. Lewis. Andrew Caddey is the CEO of City to City Australia, who are bringing Tim Keller to Oz. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you going?
Why do you think the Australian church needs to hear from Tim Keller?
Well, I think what Tim Keller is doing is finding new questions to ask that enable us to give classic gospel answers to a culture that has kind of gotten a bit bored with Christianity. And asking those new questions means that we can engage in fresh ways that actually are arresting and interesting and challenging to a post-Christian culture.
Well, can you give us an example?
Yeah. One of the things that Tim Keller's done is to try and reframe the way that we think about and talk about sin. Typically, we say sin is rebellion against God. But when you talk to your average secular person in, you know, the city or the suburbs or in your workplace, they look at you as though you're talking a strange language.
Well, I guess if you don't believe in God, then rebelling against him is kind of fictional, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly right. And so Tim has picked up on the Old Testament and New Testament category of idolatry, which is where you put your trust or your hope or your security or your identity in something other than God. It's a core category in the Bible for sin, and it's one that actually really resonates very powerfully with people in our world because we realize that actually we need hope and identity, but they can be hard to find.
Okay, well, what's distinctive about his Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City?
Well, it's grown very, very fast. It has what he calls an integrative ministry, which means that it's a whole-of-life approach to ministry. It serves the poor in a very profound way. It has a very significant integration of faith and work for young professionals that are working in the city in New York. Mm-hmm. And it's engaging the city in a very positive way. It's not negative or carping. It's not just yelling. It's looking to genuinely engage, recognizing that God is at work in the world and that our task as Christians is to draw attention to the fact that in order for people to kind of find the reality of who they are and who they yearn to be, actually, often, it's only Jesus Christ who can give answers to those questions and to that yearning.
So where can we find a church like that in Sydney?
Well, you know, modesty prevents, of course. But I'm hoping that we'll find hundreds and hundreds of them, more and more, after the conferences. Let me say one thing, though, which is the churches in Sydney won't be exactly like that because the culture in Sydney is not like New York City.
Exactly.
And so the job that Tim Keller has done in New York is not the same job that we have to do here. We have to do our own version of that job. And that's why we need a community of people who are asking the same questions of our own culture, even if they come up with different answers.
That's right. You don't want to carbon copy. Often been the church's mistake, hasn't it, to just absolutely carbon copy what someone else is doing somewhere.
And it's one of the differences with Tim Keller and the City to City movement. One of the first things they say is, and they really mean it, you know, one of our fears about Americans coming to Australia is they just say, look, here's what I've done, do the same thing. City to City says, no, here's the questions we've been asking. You answer them for yourself, what's called you contextualize your answers for your own situation.
Mm-hmm.
What City to City Australia is about is all to do with what happened after the conference.
Mm.
One of the things that we're doing is launching a department, if I can call it that, or a division of City to City Australia, which is the Australian Centre for Faith and Work. This is an especially exciting development for us. As I said, one of the key aspects of what Redeemer does in New York City is help people integrate faith and work so that they don't have their spiritual bit and then their secular bit, that their whole life is spiritual, including how they see their workplaces as the work that they do as service for God. And the Australian Centre for Faith and Work is going to be bringing out a program that's been developed in New York to help people do exactly that, to be renewed personally and also in their workplaces to genuinely integrate their work into their faith. It is a very, very exciting, highly intense discipleship program around faith and work, and that will pick up both men and women, I think, in huge numbers.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Post the conferences, yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for sharing with us about some of the stuff that you've got going on.
Really appreciate your time.
That's Andrew Katte. He is the CEO of City to City Australia. They have a number of conferences and activities coming up at the end of March. You can see them all and find out more at citytocityconference.com.